In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Charity fraud is among the most sinister crimes in the financial world that often slips by regulators and accountants. That could be why charities and foundations are known to be useful money laundering vehicles in certain arenas of leadership, such as politics. Very few investigators successfully track and expose this level of fraud. Wall Street on Parade, Ellen Brown, and other watchdog groups are among them. But our guest, Charles Ortel, has dug deep into one foundation in particular. This level of forensic investigation can become a template when unraveling the corrupt webs of similar networks and shell companies. Charles Ortel is a private investor, writer, and analyst who examines world financial markets, geopolitical developments, with a focus on exposing fraud and corruption. In 2015, he started investigations into charities, especially those appearing to operate illegally to create wealth and extend political power for their trustees, executives, and selected donors. Charles, welcome to Another News.
Thanks for having me on. It's my pleasure.
I learned about your work through Jason Goodman of Crowdsource the Truth and your collaborative show Sunday with Charles, where you both walk through the streets of Manhattan, live-streamed on YouTube, discussing a range of topics, including your investigative work into charities, specifically the Clinton Foundation. According to reports, the Clinton Charity Network is likely worth more than $100 billion. Would you tell listeners, please, what prompted you to investigate this charity?
Sure. Actually, what happened at first is I had done a lot of work exposing fraud in the for-profit area, specifically starting with General Electric, which turned my attention to GE in 2007. And that is an enormously complex mess. I called it when the shares were trading at $40 and now around $6. And the market has gone significantly up from 2007 to today. So a friend of mine knew that I could get through financial statements, and some have said that I'm actually pretty good at it. And he turned to me and said, look, I can't make hide or hair out of this Clinton Foundation. Now, I must confess that in the 90s, when Bill was president, I was very much against what he was doing, and I just didn't buy the stories, and I actually avidly read all the books that came out. So I was inclined at first to think that he was up to something no good. Then, however, when the tsunami happened, and I saw Bill get together with George H.W. Bush and fundraise, I thought, you know, maybe the guy's mellowed out, matured, because I had done a deal with one of George Bush's sons, and I had talked extensively with him about how his father felt about Clinton. And, you know, firsthand, I was told he loathes that son of a, you know. And so when I saw that, I said, well, you know, maybe there's something good here. And at the time, though, I had been on the board of several charities, I'd never actually studied the law carefully, because I figured, how can you get in trouble with a charity? Nobody's trying to steal in a charity, I thought. But when I looked at it, it took me about a week to conclude that it was a massive fraud. And I then went around, and this was in, say, February, March 2015. So it's before Donald Trump had announced that he would officially run. It was before, it was when Jeb Bush might have been, you know, the Republican nominee. And obviously Hillary was spoiling for, she hadn't announced at that point. But I knew that going into the Clinton Foundation, the way I could go into it was going to have an impact. And so I decided that I had to study it really, really carefully and refrain actually from any kind of political. I didn't even vote in 2016. I just wanted this to be all about charity fraud and the fact that presidents and former presidents should not be abusing their exalted positions to enrich themselves and their families and their supporters.
You write that the Clinton Foundation appears to be a rogue charity that has neither been organized nor operated lawfully since its inception in October 1997 to date. As you will grow to realize, you write, it is a case study in international charity fraud of mammoth proportions. Would you please explain to listeners the strategic value of creating foundations which isn't unusual for certain CEOs or politicians.
Right. So charity law is really interesting, if you like detail in law. But charity law is ancient. And it comes, our charity laws come out of, and I'm not a lawyer, but comes out of English and indeed Roman traditions. It's ancient stuff. The idea is that a charity should not be engaged, in a U.S. charity or an English charity, should not be engaged in activities that create, quote, more than an insubstantial amount of private gain. That's a term of art. So what is private gain? Private gain is not money. Private gain is any kind of edge, an advantage, burnishing your reputation, anything. You're not supposed to derive benefits personally through the operation of a charity. Instead, you're supposed to be giving away. And indeed, you're supposed to be doing it responsibly, furthering the common good, the public interest. And there are different types of charities, but all of them fall under that rubric. So none of them, you can't go, as the Clintons were, dead broke from the White House to operating a charity spread around the world and being worth hundreds of millions of dollars through the operation of that charity. You just simply are not normally allowed to do that. And in particular, this type of charity was supposed to be a what's called a public charity. There's two types. There's a public charity, and then there's a private foundation. A public charity really stands in the shoes of government and performs functions for the public good. It's not, it cannot be partisan political. It certainly can't enrich people who give to the charity or operate the charity. A private foundation, in contrast, is like the Gates Foundation. That's something where you make $1 billion and you decide to give half a billion away through something you control. You also have to operate it lawfully, but you don't have to necessarily operate it in the broad public good. So you could put Bill and Melinda Gates in charge of their own charity when they give the bunch. But the Clintons have basically controlled illegally this charity from its inception, from behind the pulpit, you know, using strings, et cetera. And they never bothered. I guess they felt at the time that they could get away with anything. They never bothered to do the niceties, the essential elements that are required to operate a charity.
People often use a charity or foundation as a vehicle to launder money. Is that true?
Sadly, it is true. And here's how it works. It's actually sobering, frankly. And in the work that I've done, it's published that are out there, I've pointed people to the types of memos that should have sent shivers up the spines of the accountants and the law firms and the trustees involved with this charity. The first step in operating a charity lawfully is to pick a location inside this country, a state or locality, Washington, D.C., where you want to organize yourself. Now, there's a little nuance I learned, and I've bought and sold many companies and seen many legal situations, but even I didn't appreciate that there's a distinction between incorporating something and organizing it. Incorporating is the first step. Typically, a lawyer or an agent will go and file articles of incorporation if it's going to be a corporation. But you're not technically organized until the trustees or the initial directors are appointed. And in the case of this foundation, they should have been all independent. They shouldn't have been related to one another and had business interests or anything. And then you have to adopt bylaws. You then have to go through certain technicalities. And at all times, you have to make sure that you file paperwork that's required in your home state. And if you go into other states, in those states. And none of this was ever done properly. I mean, it is a case study in how not to run a charity. And a lot of people have looked at this. Indeed, this was under investigation by the FBI and the Southern District of New York.
You're talking about the Clinton Foundation. Okay.
Right, from 2001 to 2005. They couldn't see this obvious fraud. So the first step is, do you actually have an entity? And before 9/11, September 11th, 2001, it was easier to get a bank account than it now is to get a bank account. So the fraudsters, if you remember back, I don't know how long you've been in New York, but if you remember back to the day when you couldn't walk around New York without seeing these tables, folding tables, with these big glass jars filled with pennies, and people were begging for pennies for the homeless, and it turned out there was no such charity. This was a Ponzi scheme where the operator basically got homeless people to sit, and they got a take of what went through the right. And so similarly, the Clinton Foundation is actually a modern version of that. It was never organized properly. Its official authorized purposes are to actually hold the presidential records of the Clinton era in a specific, not just in Little Rock, in a specific park in Little Rock, and to allow scholars from across the political spectrum to study those records. That's the only thing it's ever been approved for.
It's disorganization and improper structure. Do you think that was intentionally done, lessen their accountability in if they were ever investigated for fraud?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting point. There's an element of that, but I think it comes out of their longstanding pattern and practice. Their entire lives have been raising money for political campaigns or causes, and nobody really checks how much money went towards the cause and then what happened to the money. Indeed, in Bill Clinton's various books, and I'm hard at work on a series of books actually on this because there are many different ways you could look at it, different audiences you could sell to, professional, general public, etc. But in his book, Giving, which I joke about on the show, should have been called Taking, he actually has the gall to recount the story that it was commonplace in Arkansas to have something called COO, Raccoon, the Raccoon Dinner in Gillette, Arkansas. Apparently it's some rural place in Arkansas where there's not enough money to stand up a football team every year. So all the politicians in the state go to this little place. And Bill jokes about it on, I think it's like page 35 or something. He jokes about how everyone goes there, they raise far more money than they need, and they serve roadkill to the people with barbecue sauce. And he makes a joke out of that. You know, you look at that, that's in essence what the Clinton Foundation is. They're raising money for projects that nobody supervises properly. They write reports about what they say they're doing, but they've never been validly audited by a real tough forensic auditing team, which you need to do. And they're able because the people in the mainstream press want to get close to the Clintons and see what happens when you go against the Clintons. No one has ever, until recently, taken the Clintons to task. And in my walk through all this, I'm pleased to be with you on this show. I think I've spent a lot more time on left-leaning progressive stations than I've been on the right-leaning as well. But the issue of stealing from a charity, of diverting money from a charity, diversion is a crime in a charity. You know, when you go and you say, I'm going to raise money for a presidential library, but instead you take that money, even if it's used properly for a good cause to fight HIV and AIDS, that's a crime. You can't do that.
Charles, Exhibit 25 in your report on your website, charlesortel.com, Exhibit 25 caught my attention because on this show we talk with guests about United Nations Agenda 21 and 2030, the national level sustainability agenda. Exhibit 25, unauthorized and illegal operation of Clinton-Gayestra Sustainable Growth Initiative, CGSGI. It started in June 2007, a nonprofit corporation, you write, was illegally organized in Canada as a joint venture between Canadian persons and the Clinton Foundation. It's really interesting to me. You would think that a sustainable growth initiative would want to at least operate in a legal framework, but this reminds me of the financial fraud surrounding the quasi-state private solar power companies. What are your thoughts on CGSGI in this regard?
To start with, the Clinton Foundation has no lawful authority to engage in international activities of any type. The CGSGI was operated from New York. It never registered in New York. The Clinton Foundation has changed its name many different times. It started out the William J. Clinton Presidential Foundation. Then it became the William J. Clinton Foundation. Then it became William J. Clinton Foundation. Then it became Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. But along the way, they never changed their name properly. It's not as simple when you're operating across the states and around the world to just say, after the fact, I use this name over here. You know, I use William Jefferson Clinton Presidential Foundation. I'll use it with the, I'll use it without the. That's a classic hallmark of fraud, right? You're supposed to have one official name, and if you want to use what's called a fictitious name, a doing business as name, depending on the rules of each state, you have to file, and you have to say, you know, in Arkansas, I'm going to use these other names. And in New York, I checked carefully, New York's charities laws are actually much stricter than most states because we have many rich people here, we have high taxes, and charity frauds can cost this state a tremendous amount of money. So if you want to use a fictitious name like Clinton Justro Sustainable in New York, you have to file to register it in every single county, not just the state, in every single county. And there are five counties in New York City alone. They never did that. And I have, you know, email back from the Secretary of State that they never did that for the Maine Foundation, any of these other things. And so in Canada, the Justro piece is a really interesting piece. So Peter Schweitzer has written a great book, Clinton Cash, and he's, I think, the first person who drew to my attention, this Frank Justro guy, whose life story, in my mind, is improbable. I mean, he came supposedly from a poor family in the provinces in Canada, and before long, he's a multi-billionaire, first doing investment banking, then doing energy deals, then doing the uranium deal, then getting to the film business. All of these deals, these areas, are areas where it is possible, and I'm not saying he's doing this, but it is possible that money laundering is going on because there's no real checking. When you invest in a mine, you know, one game that I'm aware of, because I've been hurt by it, is you invest in a mine and the mine operator says, well, we mine 1 million ounces of gold this year. What if they really mine 10, right? And they keep the proceeds of 9 and denude the mine and whatever. So that's an area where he can do that. The film business is legendary for, you know, who knows what the real costs are, who knows what the real revenues are. And in investment banking, same thing. So he teamed together with Bill Clinton ostensibly to do this sustainable growth thing, but at the same time, he was also pursuing mining deals in Kazakhstan and elsewhere and other deals. And he did it not only with Clinton, he did it with this fellow in Mexico, Carlos Slim, and with Lucas Lundin, who is a person of Swedish origin. I'm not sure where he lives at this point. These folks were very interested in offshore resource extraction and exploitation deals. And there's been a lot written. Ken Silverstein and Alana Goodman have done a lot of good work looking into this. Bottom line, that entity has never been structured properly under Canadian law, under U.S. law, but it's protected, I think, in Canada because you have in Justin Trudeau, he has, believe it or not, his father put together a foundation that's even bigger than the Clinton Foundation. So I think in Canada, I can tell you in Canada, we've been trying to get the Canadian government to do the right thing and come forward and explain exactly what has been going on there. But that to me, that whole scheme, it's textbook fraud.
You call it the Clinton Charity Network. If you could give listeners an idea of how vast this charity network is and get a broader view of how complex this is.
Sure. So we'll start from base principles. It was supposed to be a library in Little Rock, and there's a lot of evidence, which we have and others have, that the project was originally estimated to cost $100 million. Now, I don't know how much familiarity you and your listeners have with construction, but construction is an area where if you have a bank that's willing to put up all the money, you can steal a tremendous amount of money in a construction project because you just say the cost overruns, and then you get some crooked appraiser to say, yeah, it's really worth this. And so it started out being worth $100 million, and by the time the project was officially finished, they said it cost $165 million. But our team of accountants, and we've got several of them, have landed on this hard and estimate that anywhere between $60 to $80 million was stolen just in that, overstating the value of the construction and getting the money from banks and donors and just only spending, let's say, $100 million or $80 million and saying it cost $160 million.
If they say they have these cost overruns, who are they? Where does this money come from?
With a charity that is connected to an operation that is also raising money for campaigns, finding money is never the problem, right? If you have vast streams of money going towards the 2000 Hillary Clinton Senate campaign and vast streams going towards the Gore's campaign, and Terry McAuliffe is on your board, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee is on the board of the Clinton Foundation, your problem is not finding money. Your problem is deciding how much money to say went to the charity, and then, you know, maybe stealing some of the money. So normally you can't get away with this if you have a real accounting firm, and a real accounting firm does a real audit of the annual results each year. There was no attempt at anything resembling an audit until consistent with the rules that are operating in this country, until 2006, until June of 2006. Yet it began operations in 1997. The people they fundraise, they raise money for, are people who are willing, and there have been New York Times articles about this, many of them, the overlap between the people who give money for campaigns and the people who give money for charitable purposes involving the Clintons. There's a tremendous overlap. Now, in the political campaign side, I'm no expert on it, but I believe there are, for individuals, low limits as to how much money you can give to a specific campaign. In addition, on political fundraising, you're not allowed to raise money from a foreign government. On the other hand, in the charity world, there's no limit how much money a donor can send your way. There's a limit, if it's an individual donor, how much money that donor can deduct in a given year based on their income. But if a donor really wants to send a lot of money to a charity and it's a leaky bucket, it's a lot cheaper for that donor to give it to a charity and have the money somehow end up in the campaign or end up paying a contractor to the campaign or whatever. And so when you don't see, I remember getting into it with, I forget the guy's name, but the person who made the big to-do about Donald Trump's taxes and who found Donald Trump's taxes is a Pulitzer Prize winning guy. And he was talking about Donald Trump's a jerk for all that. And maybe he is. But I reached him on the phone. And I said, look, have you turned your attention to the Clinton Foundation? Because I don't think there's a real audit for the Clinton Foundation. And he said, how do you know? Are you a CPA? And I said, no, I employ CPAs.
You said you don't think there's a real audit for the Clinton Foundation?
I don't think there ever has been one. Because people who are not familiar with audits, when you hear audit, what normal people think of is the IRS is going to come visit your house and go through your checkbook and in your tax return. That's not what I'm talking about. A financial audit is when a reputable, a registered in the state accounting firm goes in and does a deep dive into the consolidated worldwide operations of your charity. That's a real audit. You can have different levels of audit. You have something called a review. And that's just where an accountant comes into your room and says, oh, I see those papers over there. I've reviewed them, and that's fine. They don't independently check anything. They don't contact the donors. They don't contact the vendors. They don't verify the amount spent or received during the year, the opening and closing balance sheet. And if you're operating around the world at a time of great volatility in currency exchange rates, I mean, you can have money, you can make financial statements say whatever you want. Because, you know, things will move during the year. If you want to bury an expense, you can bury an expense. If you want to claim that what you received is less than what you really got in dollars, you can do that. If you want to inflate it, you can do it. And indeed, another trick you can do if you don't have a real accounting firm checking the donors is you could say to a political crony, you know what, you've been good to me. I didn't get this thing the way you wanted. Why don't you just make a donation for $1 million to my charity? And the political person will say, well, I don't have $1 million. Just, you know, why don't you send me whatever you can send me? I'll send you a slip of paper saying you gave me $1 million. Now you can write off $1 million, and I'll get my controller, if the IRS ever asks anything, to say you gave us $1 million. A real audit would catch all that. And there has never been, I mean, to give you an example, the auditing firm is a firm called BKD, Boy King David, which people have reported for this egregious misconduct I've been talking about on our show ad nauseum. This is a firm that was not organized properly, the accounting firm in Arkansas. It was involved filing the tax returns for the Clinton, didn't file a tax return in 1997, still hasn't filed one for the partial year, did file tax returns, never using the proper legal name of the entity, using the incorrect address, making mathematical errors on the tax return. And then also starting in 2001, for 2001 and forward, doing audits that were on the face of them. In these fake audits, they say, we are using accounting principles that are not allowed inside the United States of America. You don't need to be a genius or know anything about accounting. When you see that, you know, the normal person would say, well, this isn't an audit. And when you start out with a company or a charity, if you've never been audited, it's virtually impossible to go back to the beginning of time and say that, you know, now you can audit, right? The papers disappear. You don't know what really happened in history. So you have to do it right from the beginning, and they've done it wrong from the beginning.
Getting back to maybe where a lot of the money was generated, in constructing the building for the archives, you're suggesting maybe about $80 million. That money gets used to develop another charity or start another foundation or another company. We're going to talk about the complexity from that point. Could you elaborate more on that?
Sure. So I'll just stay on the Clinton Foundation itself, because I could talk about affiliates, but I'll focus on the Clinton Foundation first. So the library they don't begin constructing the library until 2002. All right. But also in 2002, they get very centrally involved, in theory, in a fight against HIV and AIDS. And now that's a delicate topic. There's a great lady called Celia Farber. I don't know if you know her, but she back in that time frame, wrote a wonderful article for Harper's, and she was roundly attacked for questioning whether we were fighting HIV and AIDS in the proper way. She recounted these harrowing tales of a perfectly healthy pregnant woman in this article who, you know, went in thinking that she's a normal checkup or whatever, and she tests positive for HIV and AIDS, and the article is gruesome. They immediately give her this medicine that kills her. And there's no nice way to be killed, but this is a gruesome way. Celia Farber, Harper's, look it up. So there was a rush, just as we have now with COVID. There was a hue and cry started up in Harvard after Bush was sworn in January 20th. In April of 2001, a bunch of Harvard people got together, and not using the university's official seal of approval, they just did this consensus statement on AIDS, arguing that we've got to have a gigantic trust fund because the cost of HIV and AIDS medicine is so prohibitively high that the poor people who are going to get this disease will never be able to get the money to pay for it. And, you know, that was, you look at it at surface level, and, you know, you see all these famous people, Dr. Paul Farmer, all these Harvard PhDs and MDs, and it gets eventually published in a peer-reviewed, in theory, publication. You look at it and you say, oh, maybe we should jump and do this. And so that's what happened. They jumped and they created something called the Global Fund, which came together in Geneva in January of 2002. When you read, there's a guy, I don't like his politics, but he's a great writer, called Joe Connison, and he wrote what I refer to as a confession of charity fraud, but what he thinks is an ode to Bill Clinton called, the name will come to me, but it came out in September 2016, Man of the World, it's called. And that book, he had extensive access to Bill Clinton and the Clinton team, so he was able to tell the story that they began to come up with this idea, Clinton Foundation HIV-AIDS Initiative, in January 2002, just around the same time as the Global Fund, this gigantic pot of money comes together that can pay for things. And Bill's claim to fame, which has actually been, I don't like using this phrase, but it has been massively debunked by all people, his own daughter, is that he lowered the price of HIV and AIDS medicines, but he didn't. The price of HIV and AIDS medicines, there was a very successful entrepreneur in India who ran a company, a family-owned company called Cipla, who had offered to bring the price of HIV and AIDS down drugs long before Bill Clinton had anything to do with it. Indeed, when Bill Clinton was president, our government actually went after the government of South Africa because they were trying to bring the price of HIV and AIDS drugs down using generic medicines, the way that Bill ultimately did it. So beginning in 2002, they start fumbling around, deciding that they're going to fight HIV and AIDS by distributing these drugs in poor countries. Now, I'm squeamish, and I'm certainly not a medical doctor, and I'm no expert on health. But I've traveled to 70 countries, many of them poor countries, and I know, and I'm sure people listening to this know, that, you know, the first time you go to a really poor country, you are shocked, particularly when you go into the rural portions. These countries are not densely populated in cities like our country, the United States. They have, even today, countries like Ethiopia, where Dr. Tedros is from, 70 million people in Ethiopia have no electricity today in 2020. There are more Ethiopian doctors in Chicago than there are in Ethiopia, a country of more than 100 million people. There are no paved roads to speak of. There's no electricity. There's no clean water. There are no hospitals, doctors in the same, you know, in the sizes needed. So the idea that you're going to basically fly around the world as Bill Clinton and Iron Magazine and others, using a charity that has never been operated lawfully anywhere, and start sending this medicine to places where there's no infrastructure and actually do good is highly questionable, if not, you know, frankly, medical malpractice. There's a great woman called Catherine Eban, who E-B-A-N, has written a book called Bottle of Lies. And it's all about, you know, not just the Clinton Foundation, but it's all about the dangers of spreading medicines to these countries where there's no real infrastructure to check and make sure that they're being administered properly to the people. And as in the case of COVID, people who have HIV and AIDS typically have what are called comorbidities, other conditions. And unless you test properly for HIV and AIDS, and I don't know whether by design or by accident or sloppiness, the test for HIV and AIDS outside the United States of America, outside the developed world, are not as precise. So you'll get many, many false positives. So he got involved with this. There is this book, Bottle of Lies, was built on work that Eban had done for Fortune magazine in May of 2013. She wrote something called Dirty Medicine. And this is all about a horrific company called Ranbaxy, R-A-N-B-A-X-Y, that was one of the principal vendors of HIV and AIDS medicines via the Clinton Foundation to all these different countries. And that country, remember I say Bill started on this with a magazine in January 2002. In August of 2004, so months and years into doing this, Ranbaxy got called on the carpet by a combination of the World Health Organization and the government of South Africa, because they started questioning. They didn't believe that the test results and the quality was as advertised. And the short version of a very long story is that in the Fortune magazine article, they talk about how when it went up the chain of Ranbaxy in the headquarters in India, and people really were concerned when they discovered that nothing prior to like August 2004, none of these medicines had ever been tested. Test results had been made up. They'd gone to drugstores or places to buy competing products and passed those products off as their own. And they were distributing, some believe, a lot of junk, harmful junk. And they took this to the top brass at Ranbaxy. And in the magazine, Medicine Magazine article, they say the CEO's reaction is, "Why do you care about this? We're just killing black people in Africa." It's in the article. And so, you know, mentioned that when I got involved with a charity, several charities, you know, I figured, how much trouble can you get into? You could get into a tremendous amount of trouble when you're using, you know, the patina of having been president of the United States and all your global contacts, and you say, "I'm going to address a challenge nobody else can address," and you do it poorly, and people likely die because of it. That's not something that you should cover yourself in glory with. That's not an argument for Hillary Clinton to be the next president of the United States. It's certainly not a reason to pay the family a lot of money for speeches. It's a reason to make an example of this, which is what I'm trying to do. Back just on this narrow one, my approach when I started on it was not to be competitive, but to try to share the information broadly with as many people as I could. I figured that, you know, the Clintons are very powerful. I'm not. That the ocean of public opinion across the political spectrum would inevitably, you know, bear down on these people the way they need to be. And so I reached out across the spectrum. I spent a fair amount of time with CNN. I even went down to meet with Jake Tapper to be filmed for an interview in June of 2016. And prior to doing that, I met with the, by phone, several conference calls with their top investigators in Atlanta. And I relayed this tale. And I was, you know, as I am now, you get worked up thinking about that they would do something this diabolically bad. And the guys at CNN said to me, "Why do you care so much about this?" I said, "Because it's murder. I mean, it's horrible stuff that these people are doing, and they're passing themselves off as Robin Hood." So, you know, that's the biggest piece of the Clinton Foundation, was the biggest piece of the Clinton Foundation, the official biggest piece. Then they came up with something in 2004, actually, that came together in 2005 called the Clinton Global Initiative. Now, I refer to that as the Clinton Grifter Initiative because in my experience, either being asked for money or raising money, you don't take credit for your intention to maybe someday make a pledge to maybe fund a commitment. That's not something you do. You either give the money or you pledge to give the money in a binding commitment. And the people who do this best don't want attention. It's not, I'm not Jewish, but I've been told in the Jewish faith that, you know, you're not supposed to take credit for charitable work. I like that, actually. You don't want to make the recipient of the gift to draw attention to the fact that they needed something, and you really want to truly give it away. So this Clinton Grifters Initiative came together by September of 2005, and it really, you know, in terms of a fraud, it was a masterful fraud. It remains a masterful fraud because they figured out, rather than, you know, pay to fly heads of state in, have it right around the time where all the heads of state are in New York City anyway for the UN General Assembly. Bill had been to the World Economic Forum and others had been to that one. And they said, look, we'll just do this in New York. We'll have a 2 or 3 day conference. We can get everybody into a closed room. We'll get people to brag about what they're going to do. In reality, we control the room. So we can make sure that no IRS people come in and no other people come in. And then we can say to the cronies who want to get close to these world leaders, for a modest amount of money, you can be in a room for 3 days bragging about how charitable you are in front of these world leaders. And now when you want to get an audience in Uganda or Tanzania or you name it, Canada, with someone to do something, it's so much easier. You know, we're burnishing your credentials. It really is, when you look closely at the so-called commitments to action, that's what they call them, they actually have a listing of all of them, descriptions of all of them, and some are just laugh out loud, ridiculously funny and absurd. So grandiose, a billion here, a billion there. The summary of all these things in the actual Clinton Foundation reports, the annual reports, describe amounts of money being raised that no human being could legitimately raise in that short period of time. It dwarfs the activities of well-established operations. And there are no actual audits of any of these supposed commitments to action. They sound good, but, you know, one comical experience that somebody wrote about, I think, in Vanity Fair, is there was an Italian, what Bill would do is he'd have, and I've never been to these, but they televise them so you can watch them. He would bring up on stage people who should be applauded for their charitable good works. And there was this young guy from Italy who arrived here, a really young guy, handsome guy, whose story was the following, that his father was connected to the Vatican, and the Vatican needed to raise money to pay for these sex suits. And they were going to do it by selling surplus Vatican property. He had access to, you know, to getting these churches that were going to be sold, or properties that were going to be sold. And he wanted to team with people, you know, to put together a fund, and they'd have the preferred access to get the properties at the good prices. And he actually put together a fund. He even, you know, immediately operated at a high level in New York City here because of the Clintons. And Anne Hathaway, the actress, met him. They fell in, I don't know, at love, but they started dating. He, of course, created a foundation. The whole thing was fiction. He was up on stage one year, you know, at the Clinton Global Initiative, bragging about what he was doing. And within days, he was in Rikers Island. Folieri is his last name. And he had the Folieri Foundation, whatever. So a slew. I have a joke about this. I'm not a scientist, but my father, who's still alive, is a scientist. And so I know about, from him and stuff, the idea of a law, a scientific law. So I jokingly say that I have only one law in theory to my credit, Ortel's first and only law. You take anything connected to the Clintons, anything at all, put it into Google with the word fraud, put the person's name in quotes, Clinton, and fraud, and you'll never be unhappy with the results. It's incredible. So there's story after story I could tell you about this Clinton Grifter Initiative. On the issue of operating and organizing it properly, or organizing and operating it properly, they only actually organized a legal entity called the Clinton Global Initiative in September 4th of 2009, yet it began operating in 2005, or 2004, actually. It secured an internet address in 2004, and then its first conference in 2005. But New York requires you to actually, you know, fill out the forms, have articles of incorporation and bylaws and annual reports, and if you're going to raise money for something, you've got to fill out special reports. If you're using a solicitation firm to do that for you, they have to file a report. None of this was done. And they tried to cover it all up beginning in 2009, because who spoke at the 2009 Clinton Global Initiative? None other than Barack Obama. That's probably all told, if you could ever figure out how much money went through those projects, that would be the biggest piece of it. The AIDS thing would be very large, but nowhere near as big as the Clinton Grifter Initiative. They also created something, this is a real hoot, they created something called the Clinton Global Initiative University. Now, Donald Trump got in trouble for using Trump University here in New York State. New York is very, as I say, it's particular on the books about these laws, and you cannot use the word university in New York State unless you go through the Department of Education and you jump through hoops and you meet the requirements, the strict requirements of being a university. The Clinton Global Initiative University is a complete joke. I mean, it really is. It's a bad joke. It's still operating. You know, it's never been registered. It's never filed the proper reports. It's operated across many different states. And I forget exactly what year they took off. Then you get to 2008. We may have to go back in time because there's a lot of pieces to it, but I think I'm getting most of them. In 2008, you know, imagine that Donald Trump had been elected in 2008 instead of 2016. Then imagine if Melania Trump decided between the election day and the inauguration day that she was going to hold a meeting of the Clinton or the Trump Global Initiative in Hong Kong in December 2nd, 2008. Do you think the press would have anything to say about that? And that's exactly what happened. You know, Obama wins. The official announcement that Hillary's going to be the Secretary of State if she gets to the Senate happens towards the end of, it's unclear exactly when it came together, but let's call it November 30th, December 1st. By December 2nd, they're having a meeting in Hong Kong with all these grifters, basically, and heads of state trying to figure out what the next Secretary of the State and the Obama administration are going to do. And they give money in December of 2008 to this operation. And, you know, no one says anything about it. It would be, you'd have riots in the streets if Donald Trump tried that.
That's getting into the conflict of interest, of course, with their foundation and their work in the government. And, of course, that was heavily criticized at some point, in addition to the speeches that they were giving and getting paid millions of dollars for Goldman Sachs and other entities, Coca-Cola. Have you scratched the surface here of the vastness of the Clinton Foundation?
Well, there are a few more things we might want to talk about in the Clinton Foundation itself. On the question of services, again, you're not supposed to receive being paid in your personal pocket because you're engaging in charitable activities. But this entity, which is, in my mind, a despicable operation called Laureate Education, I believe that the idea of for-profit education is loathsome, particularly if it's not going to be for a professional credential. If your teachers and the owners of an institution are training people to, you know, stuff that you're not going to make money as let's say, a sociologist, or just pick something that it's tough to actually make money. If you have a choice, and you do have a choice as a parent, as a student, going to any of the very wonderful public institutions or private, not-for-profit institutions, why would you ever insist that a child of yours take out a student loan to go to an institution that is going to make a profit off your child and is probably spending a lot of time marketing, a lot of money marketing to get other dumb suckers to send their children through this mill? Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton took $17.6 million from the Laureate Group, from around April of 2010 to around April of 2015. And that's on their tax returns. Okay? But it's not declared in any of these Clinton Foundation filings, and it absolutely has to be declared in the Clinton Foundation filings. The other thing they did, this is when she's Secretary of State, they created a secret office. It's not so secret because I know about it, 77 Water Street office, where they took the Deputy Chief of Protocol at the State Department, Dennis Cheng, and they housed him in the secret office. They didn't declare it the way they were supposed to declare it. And this guy, the Deputy Chief of Protocol in the State Department, is a person who arranges all the visits, you know, inside this country of foreign leaders, outside of American people. And that person gets enormously valuable information, the cell phone, the email contact of the assistant to this, you know. And that stuff, you know, that information in the wrong hands with people who don't understand charity laws or don't care about it can be used to raise money for campaigns illegally, for charities, for people, you know, as potentially as bribes. And there's been no real investigation into this guy, Cheng. What are his origins? You know, how did he go from being a young college graduate and London School of Economics graduate to immediately go into the Hillary Clinton senatorial campaign, then the presidential campaign, then the State Department? You know, what are his family connections? Does he have connections in China? I mean, we care about Russia, you know, this certainly seems to me, I'm not saying, you know, everybody from China is suspicious, but when you couple a foreign-connected person to a political campaign and a charity in the Clintons, you know, you're high on my list of suspects. So you have that experience beginning around 2011, I think it was. Then when Hillary on the way out, you know, all the while that she was Secretary of State, and this is a whole big other discussion, I suppose, but she was conducting the business of Secretary of State on unsecured servers, unvetted devices, and most importantly, she kept all of those records. She and her people kept those records while she was Secretary of State, and then after she left being Secretary of State until around early December 2014. Now, I'm not aware of any other case where, there may be other cases, where a very high cabinet level person, I mean, a Secretary of State is not just any old cabinet person, a very high person keeps all of the records of her or his activities in their personal custody and control, and nobody in the Obama administration says, wait a minute, why are you doing that? And the Defense Department person say, well, if Hillary's doing that, I guess I'll do it. And then I'll go work for, you know, a defense contractor or something like that. You absolutely should not have been doing that. It shouldn't have taken so long to discipline her for doing that. She should still be disciplined for doing it. During the period when she was Secretary of State, there was no Inspector General at the State Department the entire time. She brought the USAID people who had been independent, the ones who dispensed large amounts of money, under her direct control as Secretary of State. I mean, there's so many reasons to be incredibly suspicious about all that. Then she leaves. By April, they try to change the name of the Clinton Foundation to Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, implying that it's their personal thing, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Then, in a little-known fact that we've teased out on our shows, November 2nd, 2013, the Clinton Foundation illegally attempted to change its bylaws to concentrate power to run the Clinton Foundation, other than when there are board meetings, exclusively in the hands of the three Clintons, so-called Class A directors, superpower directors, never subject to review by any other director. Now, as a legal, I'm not a lawyer, but lawyers tell me that there's a weasel out of this. They have a phrase in the bylaws that, you know, when they made the change, none of the changes would be effective if they broke the law. So, you know, maybe they could say, you know, we obviously were going to break the law doing this. This is how we said we would do it, but we couldn't. They could try some kind of Clinton weasel operation to get out of it. But on the way it's written, they vested power in themselves to control a public charity, and you're strictly forbidden from doing that. The second you try to do something like that, you're out of business as a public charity. The statutes are clear, the regulations are clear, the case law is clear. You cannot do it. And you can't say, as Bill Hillary and Chelsea Clinton, that you're idiots, you know, that you have no exposure. You can't say, well, I was never Attorney General of Arkansas. I was never governor. I was never president. I was never Secretary of State. I was never a senator. I was never a PhD. I mean, you can't say that and get away with it. And you can also not say, well, we didn't have any legal advice, when you have in your books, you know, such as they exist, the fact that you spent tons of money on lawyers and accountants. So that gives you a sense of some of the facets. There are others. They've done joint ventures with other charities. They are also affiliated. Bill is affiliated with other charities. He got together with a man who went to prison, Rajat Gupta, who was, before he went to prison, he was the managing partner of McKinsey. Early in 2001, in his first week out of the White House, there was an earthquake in Gujarat, India. And so Rajat and Bill got together and said, we'll do the American India Foundation. Now, it's a smaller version of the Clinton Foundation, but it too, in my view, is a fraud.
Charles, thank you for laying out this complexity here, and it just keeps going. Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates is another key figure in the WikiLeaks emails. It was found that Mrs. Clinton's campaign considered Bill Gates or his wife Melinda as their running mate. That didn't get a chance to materialize, and now the Gates Foundation is front and center with this pandemic and vaccines. How connected are the Clinton and Gates Foundations?
Very, very well connected. And so I've studied this carefully. I even, through contacts, I warned Bill Gates personally that he was in serious trouble over this. And I got some articles written about it. People from the Gates Foundation came to Washington, D.C. and gave misleading answers to questions before the election. But you know, the basic issue that the Gates Foundation has, in my view, is that as a private foundation, you have to list out every grant that you make in a year of $5,000 or more. And you have to, you can't just say, you know, Pacifica $5,000. You've got to say, you know, what is the legal entity? What type of legal entity? What is the amount that you gave? What's the address you sent the money to? What was the purpose of the grant? And if what you do is you characterize the recipient of the grant as being a public charity, which is what the Clinton Foundation is supposed to be, when it is either not a public charity, but some other type of charity, or worse, a non-existent entity that's not controlled, or even worse, a fraud, when you say to the IRS that you did your homework and you gave money to the Clinton Foundation and it was a valid thing and it isn't, that's called a taxable expenditure. And a taxable expenditure, this regime was put together, I believe, in 1969 when they last reformed the not-for-profit realm. They wanted to make sure that wealthy people did not set up charities as an excuse to transfer money to other family members or pay off mistresses or fund lifestyle, because tax rates were really high prior to 1969. And that was a scheme that people, it was a loosely controlled area. They wanted to make sure that you really checked to make sure that any grant that was made actually went to a real entity. So unfortunately for the Gates Foundation, as I've done in many different shows, hundreds of grants aggregating, I think, $350 million or thereabouts have gone to various supposed Clinton charities that don't really exist. And worse, the Gates Foundation, year by year, is forced to say how much money they gave to each person, and you can add it up, and then you look at it and you say, well, that's a lot of money. Let's look and see if that amount shows up in the Clinton Foundation revenue side of the equation, and it doesn't. So we've done many shows on this. There indeed are certain initiatives. I forget whether it's Too Small to Fail or the Full Participation Project. They always have these jazzy names. There's something they're doing together, Bill and Melinda and Bill and Hillary, and indeed when she was called on the carpet when she was, I think, at the UN for some reason, and she had to answer questions about the emails. She was late to the press conference, and she invoked the name of Bill and Melinda, saying, I'm sorry we were late. I know there are issues you want to deal with, but my husband and I do a lot of work with Bill and Melinda Gates and the charitable, you know, trying to look over here. I'm really a good person. I'm a philanthropist. And, you know, when you think about the Gates Foundation, a lot of red flags. First, they hired Rajat Gupta to come up with a strategy for the Gates Foundation, deciding to focus on HIV and AIDS. They hired McKinsey and specifically Rajat Gupta. Rajat Gupta spent a lot of time at the Global Fund, this thing that was, some estimate, responsible people estimate that 2/3 to 75% of the money that was raised for the Global Fund was stolen. And we're talking here about, you know, out of, let's say, 40 plus billion, 2/3, 75% stolen. Rajat was intimately involved with the Gates Foundation, with Bill Gates. He was on, you know, advising him in private capacities. And they hit on this idea of vaccines and other support in the global health field without, I think, in my mind, doing the thinking rigorously. I mean, here's a guy, Bill Gates, is supposed to be smart. He certainly, if he isn't smart, he certainly has enough money and people that he could have bought some smart people to say, okay, if I'm going to go into Ethiopia and I really want to help these people, and, you know, I discover this person in the middle of Ethiopia who's 150 miles away from a hospital has AIDS, maybe I should build a road and maybe I should have some electricity. I mean, how much infrastructure is needed to truly address these health needs? And are we going to get there by just focusing on medicines as opposed to focusing on the actual infrastructure that's needed? So they're intimately involved. To put it charitably, I think the Gates Foundation has been enormously sloppy. There are tales we could talk about in India. They got involved in some polio vaccine program. They were kicked out of India because that was a disaster. People have written critical books. But you have to be careful with Bill Gates if you're in the academic field, because his foundation supports most universities. If you're in media, you have to be careful because, you know, Microsoft advertises and he's got a lot of money. So very few people have been willing to, you know, take out a walking tall bat and say, Bill, you know, you reform or else.
Oh, it's really interesting. And he's also involved in geoengineering or climate engineering. That's another realm that he's involved with. there were a lot of questions on this issue, such as how did the Clinton charitable work intersect with their for-profit speeches? Were there quid pro quos invoking U.S. policy? A lot of this came out of WikiLeaks. One client, Coca-Cola, received a face-to-face meeting with the former president at his home in 2009 after contributing millions to the nonprofit foundation. What are your thoughts on this method of raising money?
It's diabolical. I mean, there's a fellow who's made a lot of money off the Clintons called Doug Band, who's gotten a certain amount of notoriety in the WikiLeaks Podesta dumps. Outcome came a memo authored by Doug Band, who is a lawyer and who's, I think, still a member of the bar in Florida, basically, in my view, confessing to charity fraud. And it recites just a memo that went to the law firm Simpson Thacher explaining what he was doing at the Clinton Global Initiative, where he takes credit for basically Clinton Inc. He calls it Clinton Inc. For arranging these speeches and catering to. He specifically mentions Coca-Cola, you know, getting them to donate to foundation, getting them to pay speeches to Bill. My view on these speeches, and I will call out H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan even. Ronald Reagan, I'm a fan of his for what he did at the time he was president. But when he left and in 1989 or 90 took a multi-million dollar payment from Japanese business people to give speeches in Japan, I just thought, that was said at the time, it's outrageous. I mean, because if you're going to bribe a former president of the United States, I mean, I don't believe you should do it. But certainly isn't, you know, whatever a former president of the United States can do for you, isn't it worth more like a billion, not like, you know, a million or something like that? So I think you shouldn't do it to begin with. But if you're going to steal, I mean, steal properly.
That's going to do it for the first part of this interview with Charles Wortel. You've been listening to In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.